Welcome to the Archipelago of Design's Tension podcast series. My name is Philippe Beaulieu-Brossard, and I am the co-executive president of the Archipelago of Design. In this second episode, we are going to unpack the core tension between military design on the one hand and civilian design on the other. Indeed, they may rely on similar underlying principles, but their different contexts of application changes everything. On the one hand, military design aims at developing novel strategies and operations, as well as organizations, to preserve relevance or gain an advantage against the test of time. And in contrast, civilian design methodologies aim to develop new products or services to increase competition in a market or provide better services in the public sector. And in between, indeed, where they meet best is when addressing organizational challenges. We can think about health services, for instance, conduct, or recruitment. So today, we are fortunate to receive a panel of leading experts, both representing military design methodologies and civilian design methodologies. Representing military design, we have Jeffrey Van de Veer. Jeffrey is a planner at the G5 of the Bundeswehr Joint Force Operations Command, based in Hamburg, Germany. We have also with us Ben Zwabelsen, who is the Program Director for Design and Innovation at the Joint Special Operations University, based in Tampa. Representing the civilian design side, we have Professor Philip Cash from the Danish Technical University. And we have also Robin van Oorschot, also a professor at the Danish Technical University. And to represent both sides at the same time, it's my pleasure to have Nathan Schwegler, who is the co-founder of the Daily Museum Labs, and he is now a leading instructor at the Joint Special Operations University, together with Ben Zwabelsen.
Hi, I'm Ben Zwabelsen. I'm an American, retired infantry officer, and I'm currently a doctoral student at the University of Lancaster. I teach design. I do design theory. I'm really excited about design, particularly in military and security contexts. I also am the program director for design and innovation at the Joint Special Operations University that provides education to the U.S. Special Operations Command, as well as Department of Defense and international militaries, where I am there as a contractor. And anything said during this podcast that I happen to remark, of course, are my own private opinions and do not reflect the government.
Could have followed that. My name is Philip Cash. I'm an associate professor at the Technical University of Denmark. I work with design thinking and designer behavior, particularly in the engineering context. And I also work with behavioral design or design for behavior change.
I'm Jeffrey Van de Veer. I'm a Dutch colonel working as a J5 planner in the German Operations Command and have been bringing in design into the Netherlands, establishing it into the majors course, taking it along to Germany, trying to get something move over there. So we'll see about that one.
Hello, my name is Nathan Schwegler. I teach with Ben at the Joint Special Operations University, but as he mentioned, sharing perspectives and opinions as an individual practitioner. So a contractor providing facilitation services for the military, both within the United States Department of Defense, as well as international allies and partners around the world. By trade, and probably the perspective that I'll be bringing to the table today is from a creativity theory perspective. So individual level and team-based creativity and how that ladders up to affect organizational thinking.
Yes, and my name is Robin van Oorschot, also from the Netherlands. And I have a background in product design, not so much in engineering, but more the artistic, fluffy side of design, so to say. Right now, I'm working at the Technical University of Denmark at the entrepreneurship department. So where I'm looking at, okay, how can you bring design ways of working and design ways of teaching into entrepreneurship?
Excellent. Thank you so much. So just to get us started, what is design thinking from the perspective of your profession or from your personal perspective, and what makes it unique in your profession? Want to start?
I would say design thinking is a slightly abused term, perhaps, in that there are three or four distinct themes of design thinking and different schools of thoughts. Like there's the American, the more European, and there's sort of military design thinking, obviously, which share some commonality in dealing with uncertainty and being flexible in the face of kind of radical innovation demands. They share that iterative nature of working through not just a linear process, but kind of iterating with more like a sprint mentality. And they also share principles of reflection and development in that regard. So from my point of view, design thinking is very much about the thought process and principles that underpin design, especially when you're dealing with very uncertain, unknown goals, particularly.
And you are in contact with both engineers and architects. So is it different? Do you teach different design differently to the engineers in comparison to the architects? Or do you teach exactly the same thing to these two audiences?
I attempt to focus on underlying principles of design and then more or less leverage the different perspectives that people bring with them to illustrate how those principles are built into the ways that they work. So typically, I mean, a lot of the processes that are formalized are kind of embodiments of these underlying principles or attempt to do something with them. But by distilling out then the core principle, it can be a good way to show commonality and also to help engineers to understand what the architects are up to and the architects to understand what the engineers are up to and where the sort of commonality of thinking can be. And particularly because I teach professionally design thinking as well, and that covers a huge range of fields and disciplines that people come from. It's quite important then to sort of focus on more. It's dealing with uncertainty, it's the flexibility, it's the take action and then pivot kind of processes rather than a one-size-fits-all methodology that can just be delivered.
Excellent. And what are your thoughts, Nathan, about design from your perspective? Basically, you were a designer focusing more on corporations and now armed forces. So from your perspective, what is design thinking and does it really matter in what kind of profession you are using?
So I've had the good fortune of being able to, as you mentioned, practice methodologies, a wide range of them, as Dr. Cash mentioned. You know, there's different ways of thinking about practicing design, and it shows up differently in different cultures. Different methodologies, tools, and techniques work differently depending on the population and the problems that you're working with. So the principles are steady. The psychological and biological drivers of the thinking and the cognition are steady, but it's the sloppy human behaviors and the poor habits that we bring to the table as flawed humans that give us requirements to shape our processes differently depending on what we're trying to accomplish. So what that looks like in an undergraduate entrepreneurship course, which I used to teach, is similar to your experience, is going to look differently because you're trying to identify an interesting problem with a big enough market segment so that you can develop a value proposition and then prototype it and bring it to market in a way that you're de-risking it and sort of bring on capital and growing an organizational structure along the way versus designing a building where you're going to communicate with engineers and architects and thinking up concepts that at the end of the day have to serve a user, but you have a multi-stakeholder perspective because the city is going to care and the building materials are going to have limitations in terms of what they can accomplish. And the engineers and the lawyers, it is so many people are going to care about different things that design becomes critical and that you must be able to empathize and appreciate the different perspectives and the problems and value propositions that are required in order to make that to life in the world. And then in a military context, they've got very specific and security-driven requirements where human lives truly are on the line, feeding and clashing worldviews and paradigms and mental models about what is right and how we should, what we should believe in, epistemological confrontations. And just at that level, you encounter these really multifaceted problem sets. I think that's why design is taking on such an interesting, or why there's such an uptick in appetite for military design or design applied in military context, because it's not just a tool, not just a methodology, but a way of seeing the world, which provides us perhaps a little bit of light at the end of a tunnel of a very long series of conflicts that have had no meaningful resolution.
What we see, like both Dr. Cash and yourself mentioned principles, and that the principles are steady. They don't change if you go across different discipline professions and all that. So could you give an example of principle that resonate in the corporate world in comparison to the military world?
I think right off the bat, when you look at the body of knowledge around personality psychology is probably an interesting entry vector into this, because we were just talking about architecture. I think architects have an interesting connection to this. But in the 1960s at the Institute of Personality Assessment Research at Berkeley, I think the guy's last name was Barron, but he had done this large study trying to figure out who the most creative profession was in the world. And I see you laughing and shaking your head. Interestingly enough, architects, by and large, were the most creative profession. And I thought that was interesting because when you think about the requirements, what it takes to be a great architect, they need to be able to see around corners, to pull the future into the present, to sketch these concepts and communicate that vision, to a financier or an organization that will capitalize the build out of this infrastructure project. But then to then understand and craft an experience for people who are going to use that space, while also acknowledging and considering the limitations of the building materials and all the things, all the effort that's going to have to go into that process to create that thing. Just an extraordinary range of creative leaps I think you have to make to be a successful architect. So when you jump that back to the what's a universal thing that you think is appropriate or sort of applicable in a design context, I look to contemporary research on personality. And I'm a huge fan of personality research by and large. I think it went through a 10 or 20 year dark period of sloppy methodology. But there's the big five is the general consensus model right now, five relatively stable personality constructs. One of them is considered to be openness to experience. How open are you to the world around you? Do you read books and magazines and things outside of your discipline? Do you travel to places where they don't speak your native tongue? Do you eat at restaurants with types of food that you don't necessarily enjoy or haven't had before? How willing are you to move your personal experience of the world around you into spaces that you've never had before, felt before, known before? This interesting sort of openness, curiosity, and wonder, that tends to be, I think, the most potent attitude or personality trait that I could think of that would add value in a design context. But I'd throw that back out to the group.
So, Robin, what kind of principles for you, what is design thinking in your field?
I found it interesting what you were mentioning about the architecture with architecture, because I apply education in product design and really crafting products as well. And that's something very interesting, like that you have all this openness and this look at the world, talking with users and stakeholders. And how do you then translate to actually making an art? That's what I find one of the biggest challenges in design thinking. It's like, okay, you can do the whole thinking, but if you're not making it into something material, because you learn so much when something becomes materialized, because you can feel like, hey, the user meant this and that and that, but now I have it in my hand and it doesn't feel right. Like, hey, the user cannot work with it in this way. And I think that works very well in the actual design context. And then you're testing the concepts with other people, like in a presentation or a vision. And it's sometimes lacking that materiality. So that's what I find interesting challenge. Even though you're not working with design thinking with the aim to make something out of material, how can you still bring this materiality in? Mm-hmm. That's at least for me an important factor in working with design thinking, like also working with startups. I'd be curious to know how you've been working with that. Especially for startups, like how can you, because you don't have the budget to make big products right away, you have to start with something small and tangible that you can present to clients, investors, stakeholders. And how can you use design thinking to make that prototype, that minimal viable product? So that's what I see as an important factor in design thinking, is like, how does that element of materiality work in there?
An interesting twist on that, the use case you just described, is the minimum viable product isn't intended to be sold. It's designed to learn.
Exactly. Yes.
So I think that's a unique aspect and something that I really appreciated. I really like the way that the startup community has embraced what you want to call it, lean startup, or you know, the business model canvas, Osterwalder and Steve Blank and those folks, people who've been able to take this concept of design thinking, apply it to the startup world so that you can reduce the cost of failure and speed up the learning. I think if you can accomplish those two things, you know, your first product is off to a great start. I think it was Mark Andreessen who suggested that if you're not embarrassed by the first version of your product, then you've waited too long to ship it. Hmm. You should actually be mortified at showing this thing to other people because it's, you know, wrapped in duct tape or glue, or, you know, literally or metaphorically, you know.
And Jeffrey, you've been learning design and you try to implement it in your day-to-day job. For you, what is the core principle that, you know, resonate the most with you and your profession?
Well, one of the core principles is to bring it into your culture, in the military culture. And when I was teaching, you have the military culture of planning, and planning to a deliverable in a linear way. And when you have products, you're going to solve the problem as if the problem has been frozen, and then you achieve victory. But if you, the first thing was to take it back to the essence of planning, as Eisenhower already said, plans are worthless, but planning is everything. Planning in itself is a learning process. When you bring that up, you bring that into the light, planning is a learning process, and you project it on the students. What are we planning? And as a military, we are always planning on the known knowns and on the known unknowns, because the known unknowns must be the known knowns. From the known knowns, we start moving forward of the reality. So you need to open up to the world, as already mentioned before, and to move away from your problem-oriented approach that there is a problem, because that's not necessarily a problem. So the first steps are thinking about thinking. And I always told my students, you need to feel yourself comfortable in dealing with uncertainty. And design in itself is not necessarily, in a military process, the deliverable, because the design as a learning process, the outcome is already very valuable and contributes to a bigger whole.
I really agree with that perspective that design is very much a learning process, and that's one of the ways that we teach design to be valuable and for designers to communicate their value in the organization is to show that in something like a radical innovation project where the outcome is very uncertain, a huge amount of the value is delivered by the capability development of team members and their ability to leverage that across the wider organization and also to deliver insights, new problem perspectives, and new solutions that are maybe not their final outcome, but can be spun off across the whole organization. So really thinking about it as this unknown space that you kind of navigate through, but in that are developing your skills, your organization, and also the portfolio of possible problems and possible solutions, where kind of in the end, the final outcome is obviously valuable, but not the primary purpose.
Yesterday, Ben Zbarbus and Nathan Schroeder and I were teaching an introduction to design thinking for 18 majors from Danish Defense. And Ben mentioned that for him, design thinking is a methodology or an opportunity to reflect about ourselves in a complex adaptive system. So would you say that this is for you the core of design thinking in your profession?
Well, I want to be a little provocative, but what I really want to get into is not necessarily the what, the methodology or the outputs or the language within it. I want to talk at that more abstract level, the epistemological, of why and how are groups of humans doing design? And what is the nature of that, their intent on creating something that the organization hasn't seen yet or is a game changer or, as Nate says, seeing around the corner? And what I think is an important distinction here is that militaries and security organizations, whether it's local law enforcement, a drug cartel, or a terrorist group, these are all different security apparatuses. Now, some obviously are stakeholders that we don't want to be having security, and others do, but it's all about the monopoly of violence in order to impose and govern human behaviors. Militaries are the clients for all commercial design endeavors, whether it's software, architecture, or advertising. You pick the militaries and security organizations are consumers of these things. But militaries don't do design in a commercial sense. This is a poorly grasped, I think, distinction when we start talking about, well, what do we mean by design? What do we mean by the methods? And what I'm really getting at here is that think about a JDAM, which is a guided bomb that essentially swims through the air using fins and infrared and all this high-tech stuff to hit targets with incredible precision. It's a miraculous, amazing, destructive, horrifying modern weapon system. And it was designed. It was using a combination of industrial and human-centered design, software design, all these different things. And it was advertised using advertising design, of course, and sold to the military. Now, you also have tear gas, right? It's used everywhere. That also had all those same things done. Security organizations consume these products. Where is the distinction? The distinction is the commercial design orientation at an epistemological level is to produce more and more products or user experiences, of which are things between JDAMs and tear gas. But it's not on the commercial design methodology on how those are employed. It's the application of violence, which is where security design is used. And this goes back to Robin's point, which is how do you create something that's a tangible design if the military is not really doing anything tangible? The military doesn't make a product. The military is using the products, but they're using it in remarkably challenging and complex ways, and also horrifying ways. And I can't underemphasize the point of that the application of organized violence or war or action short of war, which is what we're kind of in right now with this sort of gray zone or whatever we're calling it. This is a very, very dynamic security context of which security forces are in. And they're trying to make sense of the world. Going back to what Jeff said, they want to plan in a linear, causal, reverse engineered methodological way of planning. And it's not working above the tactical or the technological level. And they are buying lots and lots of consumer products that are delivered by really good commercial design methodologies. But where the militaries are really struggling is, how do we properly apply the application of violence in order to achieve these things that our political elites want?
It's interesting you talk about the monopoly of violence. Then you also offer this gray zone or conflict short of, competition short of armed conflict. This popular concept. And then some of the more forward-looking strategy papers that have come out of at least U.S. Special Operations Command talking about influence is actually being the coin of the realm in great power competitions. It's not actually the application of violence, perhaps the application of influence. And from that perspective, would you see more overlap from civilian design to act to influence through whether it be behavior modification or these sort of nudge behavioral economics approaches to getting people to behave differently? Or do you think that truly the application of violence is the single game in town for the military?
So when I say application of violence, the implication there is if we really get into brass tacks, it's sometimes the influence or the suggestion or the ability to use. So a great example is when you're driving your vehicle or riding your bicycle, if you're here in Copenhagen, and you see a police officer at the corner. Most of us aren't hardened criminals and worried that the police officer is got an arrest warrant from Interpol and is ready to get us. But even those people are still under the influence of the application of violence. Normally, for most people, it still governs our behaviors that if you're driving recklessly, it's going to change your behavior or it's going to cause a reaction, even though the police officer isn't using violence. And so the militaries are doing this when they're doing, say, foreign internal defense, or they're doing outreach, humanitarian assistance, all these non-lethal activities. And when historians look at the 20th century, the minority of it is going to be that total war, high-intensity type conflict. A lot of them are these low-level, low-intensity, peacekeeping, counterinsurgency, humanitarian type activities. So violence here is not necessarily the application, but it goes into the influence. And where we're moving in the 21st century, which I think is a really fascinating and highly challenging area, artificial intelligence, machine learning, cyber, virtual reality. If a human being inside of virtual reality who's participating with other human beings that are also in that cyber virtual reality, if something is done in there in the ones and zeros, which then causes that person to do something in the real world here that has tangible military outcomes, where do we say that the violence occurred? Can you have that violence in cyber? Can artificial intelligence be responsible for that application of violence? Can someone who's doing a commercial design activity directly relate into the application of violence for a military? And these are some of those squishy gray areas where we go, wait a minute, that's not what we do. Each design field sometimes gets locked into their epistemological choices, and they sort of become unaware of the other types of design going on in this complex reality. And the danger there becomes when someone becomes single design minded, it turns into what Jeff was talking about, the planners. And they're on both sides. They're in the civilian world, in the businesses, and they're in the military on these some of these staffs where they say, there's only one way to do anything. And it's the way my doctrine says. If you have somebody doing design saying, there's only one way to do design, and it's the design I was taught or it's the design my company does, which, by the way, you're more than willing to purchase. So this is where I get a little bit critical. Maybe skeptical too, is that there are a lot of ways of doing design, but the question really goes back to those epistemological and ontological choices. Why and how are we doing design?
What would be your answer to this question? Why should engineers do design?
Interesting that we're in the military context, because one of the things that we treat pretty explicitly at DTU and in the design education is that a primary guiding purpose for the education of engineers and the education of designers is to make the world better. Typically also prioritizing sustainability goals and also considering the ethics in which we're operating as designers, being that we have a huge potential to change the context in which people live. So usually we're very careful to frame everything. Well, indeed, we're always very careful to frame everything towards a positive outcome where we know that side effects cannot always be predicted, but we're at least trying to look in that direction where we're led by these kind of larger goals. Particularly in the behavior change, behavioral design context, it's very much careful evaluation of all of the mechanisms that are used, and the framing of the problem itself is essential to ensure that we're empathetic to the people on the receiving end, but developing that process, and there's a responsibility there that we steward the whole process long term, not just deliver something, but it's designing a new way of living.
You've done some research on this area. It's something, a topic that you're interested in, isn't it?
Yeah, essentially, the co-creation is an absolutely essential part. So this is where I think the empathetic side of design thinking is quite important, in that you can never just ask people to change without really deeply understanding their worldview and why they behave in the way they behave. And there are many mechanisms for changing behavior, but these cannot be just fired off. It's too easy to change people's behavior in many ways.
Practitioners who are out there in the world designing experiences for other people as if that was their purview, right? Like the ego involved there is an interesting topic to dig into. And I know, Ben and Jeff, maybe you have experience in this and that. I remember you telling a story in particular, Ben, about doing design in Afghanistan, but guess who was not in the room?
The Taliban.
The Afghans.
The Afghans, right?
Yeah. Because of classification, which in itself becomes a barrier that the military organization is using to be more bureaucratic, to risk reduce, to converge, to gain efficiencies, and all those things. And now it's actually working against the very thing it would try to do, which is be creative, be innovative, be imaginative, be a game changer for the military context.
Be empathetic, right?
Be able to.
Yeah. And from my experience, that also this brings a critical mass. What I saw in teaching in the Netherlands, soldiers are pretty much intellectual averse, and they see when you start talking about ontology, epistemology, you need to put on your cloaking device and then go forward with them. But if you bring in civil partners, if you bring in other people in your design class, in your design group, and you start chasing views, you incorporate them, then it's easy to open yourself up and say, hey, it's got added value. And then that was pretty much forming a critical mass to move forward. If not, then, well, you bounce up until the opinions people already have, and it needs to be an experience as well. And from that perspective, co-creation is a very important one.
And that's perhaps a limit for the military. It's very difficult to co-create with your enemy. I remember Alex Ryan, who's a design expert now based in Toronto, saying that the Dockery only owns when there was a co-creation process with the FARC in Colombia. And they were able to do this co-creation process with them by phone because they were in jail. And they were able to participate to the process like that.
Yeah, you need to bring in them as well. Also, your so-called opposing forces. To whose opinion are they opposing? Are they opposing to me? Somebody else, it's their solution. Mm-hmm. So it would be very unwise not to incorporate their position, their views, and those things. Mm-hmm. That's a very important one. Yeah.
To wrap this up, would you...
Thank you, one more.
Oh, I was just interested in what you were saying about civilian design thinkers, you were calling me. It's interesting for me to learn about this difference between the civilian view and then...
I've told Nathan about this. So I originally started off as a graphic designer.
Yes.
And then I joined the military. And I remember engaging with some commercial designers a couple of years ago, and they had the same exact reaction of, we've never been called civilians.
So it's just an interesting point to learn. It's okay, you have to civilian designers. And I think it's interesting that we just had this discussion about, okay, maybe they are in a position to incorporate the views of, in this case, the Afghanistan people. But then it's like, okay, how do you then, as a civilian designer, how can you still sell your products to the client? So I think there's something interesting there about, okay, what is the position that design companies have? Because you're opposing all these tools that we can use in the military, and they don't always know to which end they create it.
And this goes into non-linearity and emergence.
Yes.
The emergence challenge is on both sides. Going back to the tear gas and the JDAM, we don't design a better JDAM. Now, we may ask, because we are the clients, we may ask for these different things. Hey, we really like the JDAM to be able to split into two if we need it so we can hit two targets a mile above. You know, something, well, let's just throw it out there. Mm. That's kind of crazy. There are. So if a commercial designer, an organization that provides JDAM development, they can go now do that commercial process of saying, hey, is this even feasible? Let's prototype. Well, we know you asked for that, but here's something better. That goes into the development of these tools. Now, the consequences in a complex adaptive system, a new product that a commercial designer introduces is going to radically change the market into different ways. So the cars, the automobiles that provided us this incredible new way of transporting, it also brought about, indirectly, a huge rise in automobile deaths.
Hmm.
Because before automobile deaths, you had other types of deaths and accidents, but you didn't have automobile deaths because human beings weren't moving at that high rate of speed. So now you have this challenge in America. You know, there's tens of thousands of people that die on our highways every year, but there's not really any outrage because we tolerate that. We tolerate a certain number of opioid deaths. We tolerate a certain number of alcohol deaths, cancer deaths, and now automobile deaths. And we're fine with that. Now, let's say that this movement for driverless technology is successful. In the next 20 years, 30 years, all vehicles are artificial autopilot. Human beings don't drive anymore, which now suddenly plummets those accidents down to near zero. Essentially, nobody dies in a car accident, right? Which sounds great because now commercial designers have created a consequence That's absolutely fantastic. It's made the world better, as Phil said earlier, right? However, what's the emergent potential that may actually kill more people in that world? And we don't know what it is. So I'll throw out a wild speculation. People that are now consumed with living in a virtual world and are using their devices as they're in these cars because they don't have to drive anymore. Something is happening in that world, which then causes them to feel despair, because we're already seeing that human despair in first world countries and industrial countries right now is at the highest level ever recorded. And there are more suicides and there are more opioid addictions. There are more drug-related deaths that have to do with despair and psychological issues. Is that correlating? And if so, is that a consequence that we're not really aware of in this new cyber technology, socially connected, constructed world?
And there, you're saying that I'm going to get my commute time back, but yes, then I'm going to increase my despair levels because I get 3 hours back, you know, per week, whatever. I think that's a leap. But at the same time, I'll give you, we'll go down this path. What if, you know, the emergent security risk is if you've got networked automated mobility or transportation solution, highly technologically capable, enabled non-state actor all of a sudden can do a massive hijack of your communication system from vehicle to vehicle and cause not one car accident or not the 10 to 40,000 or whatever the number is per year in the country, but instead smash every single car into each other all at once. I think there's zero resilience sometimes in some of these newer systems, because if you've never faced that threat before, if you've never seen it, if you haven't seen it coming, now individual actors that are super empowered or technologically enabled can cause massive chaos at a scale that they never could have.
Because there's new vulnerabilities in this new automated system. I think Adam Cutler from IBM was talking about this the last time we engaged with him, and that everything is automated on your roads. Then a couple of individuals can simultaneously interrupt the entire flow of traffic by violating the pedestrian law, because the AI is automatically going to redirect not just the individual vehicle, but all the vehicles in that area, which once again goes into design consequences. And this brings us all the way back to, I think there's a commonality between commercial and military security design concerns, is we're in a complex reality. We don't really know what we're doing tomorrow, but we're sure as heck trying to fix today. Mm-hmm. And the design activities that we do today, we're trying, militaries, just like commercial designers, are trying to make a positive outcome. However, the application of a tear gas grenade or a JDAM, when used judiciously, is supposed to bring about a better tomorrow, at least for the entity using those systems. And for the commercial designers that are creating better versions of those based on client needs, they also want that better tomorrow. But what happens when we deal with the consequences that tomorrow is not as we intended as designers?
It's just a loop. Like the military is going to come back with new requirements. The civilian designers are then going to meet those requirements in order to, you know, make money and grow their business, right?
So, and we'll get back to AI later. Would you agree with me that in design and its principles and all that, there is an ethics of novelty? You know, you should bring something that did not exist before. You should do something that is well crafted, so doing a job well. But all the other ethical aspects that you mentioned are external to design in itself. It needs to be added. So for instance, if the key is to be more reflexive when we use design thinking, it's not necessarily embedded in the methodology itself, which make it perhaps easier to take it to negative outcomes from a humanistic perspective.
The thing that I think of most when you ask the question is, in 1949 in the U.S., he was the president of the American Psychological Association, and he gave his presidential address in September of 49, and he was a statistician by trade, so everyone expected him to give this new statistical formula or unveil a new quantitative process. But instead, he got up and argued that as a field, we were completely blind or unprepared to think about creativity. And I thought that was a fascinating, it's considered to be like a watershed moment in psychological research, in the sense that he threw down the gauntlet and is like, look, we need to figure out this creativity bit, because ultimately it ladders up to national security, right? Like, it's a competitive advantage issue. We need to figure out how to operationally define it. And then, is it teachable? Is it learnable? You know, like, what are all these, how do we get our heads around creativity? And a whole bunch of psychological research teams then kind of were taken to task by this thing. And they spent 10 years trying to come up with a definition for creativity. And in 1961, a guy published a paper where he'd synthesized all the different competing operational definitions of creativity that all these teams had come up with. And he distilled it down to two principles: novelty and utility. Is it new? And is it useful? Mm-hmm. And those have been relatively stable. I mean, there's some people have made little tweaks to, you know, they try to put their own spin on it. But at the end of the day, I think those are your two primary criteria. So if you're in the business of creativity or design, and, you know, around this table,
That's what you're looking for. It's novelty and utility, the sweet spot between the two. If it's only novel and it doesn't have value, then it's just weird. If it has tons of value, but it's not new, then you've just copied something. Okay?
And what's interesting is that all the other ethical aspects that can come out of the design process are more of a byproduct or a great byproduct. But for instance, in all of the design education activities that are organized, that's what you see often, that you set the floor, you have a facilitator facilitate, and then the kind of reflections that the students bring are very reflexive. So for instance, when we were trying to design the LC initiative, it's a Canadian initiative sponsored by the UN, and the goal is to increase the number of women in the military and armed forces in Ghana. And most of the students were like, the way the challenge is framed is very paternalistic. Actually, we should see this thing as a challenge with Ghana, because if you look at the numbers, Ghana is way more advanced than Canada in terms of women in uniform. So although it was not as part of the perhaps the principle of design, it came out as a byproduct of doing design.
Is anybody tracking the movement around inclusive design or inclusive innovation? As a pushback against this paternalistic thing that's happening sometimes with some of these design initiatives?
Not explicitly, but the work, because it's aligned with pro-social design and understanding that an individual has a desire and autonomy and wishes to behave in certain ways that, you know, sometimes society doesn't want them to do. And there's a trade-off there that we can't simply dictate, but we also can't ignore that we live in a society and that there are clearly some behaviors that are positive for everyone. I think in response to your point about creativity, I think design thinking is more than creativity because it highlights this uncertainty and empathy aspects that it almost by definition deals with these ethical issues of. There is somebody at the end of this process who is also autonomous and has desires that need to be respected and can challenge also the paternalistic social perspective. And I think as you go then more into behavior change, it needs to be this long-term working with individuals, understanding their perspective, but also understanding society's perspective and that there's a trade-off.
I think in particular, if the people who are experiencing the effects of your design don't feel empowered or aren't in a position, if they're a marginalized population or something, like if you're not in a position to be able to push back against the design concepts that are being imposed upon you, what then, right? Mm. So one firm in particular that I'm thinking of is based in Cambridge called No Innovation, K-N-O-W, Innovation. They've got a team there who will only do design if the majority of participants come from the user population, right? So as an ethical choice. We know how to do it ourselves, but if we're not sort of working with end users, but then also developing their own design capabilities in that process, then we're just not going to do the job. And I think that's a particularly interesting and then potentially enlightened position on it relative to the majority of practitioners that I see in the world.
I'll tag onto that now. I'll keep it kind of general, so non-attributional. There was a military organization that was going through a significant challenge, things in the newspapers and things in the media that was embarrassing to that that entity. And so they wanted to do an emergency session to look at a cultural organization and change. They initially stated that they wanted a large group of 20 or so very, very senior leaders and retired leaders from that organization to assemble. They would be able to render what needed to be fixed. My response to that when I was this council on, hey, could you give us some military design on this? Are we doing this right? And we came back with, look, for every one senior leader that you put in this workshop, you must put a brand new qualified or from combat millennial member of your military organization. So if you've got 20 of these senior people, you better bring in 20 of the freshest, newest perspectives of people that are on the ground right now. Otherwise, you are wasting your time. You're doing exactly what Nate is saying, is that you're not going to change your organization because you can't even see what's wrong. And that's absolutely critical for you. If you're going to do design, whether it's a security or a commercial context, if you're not bringing in the right stakeholders, you're not bringing in the right perspectives, and then right from the beginning, you're probably just going to do what you want to do, which isn't what you need to do.
Good point. I just want to go back to the question of trade-offs and to bring this more and try to generate more takeaways for people that are listening would like to practice design across professions. So for instance, Jeffrey, if you would have, let's say, a graduate from Delft University, which is the biggest design program in the Netherlands, would tell you, oh, I just got a contract to give design introduction to Dutch officers. What kind of advice would you give?
Well, from that perspective, I would actually concur with what Ben actually said, because when I look at design in our organization and when I was teaching the majors, those more or less are the millennials. Those are the young guys from the field. They understand it. They are being raised not in the post-industrial thinking. They think differently. When I look in my organization, if we look at Mintzberg, it's a divisional structured bureaucratic system where people proceed. So they are being rewarded in their thinking and they gradually have their bureaucratic kingdom. So we do not have to convince the young guys. Because when I told design to the young guys, yeah, sure. It's nothing special. Yeah, I can follow it. It makes sense. When I teach the older guys, then they see it as a direct threat on their position, on their thinking. So you should not just focus on the younger guys. I would say you should be more open to the entire population of the organization or the audience you are teaching to. So also the older guys, also the people who say, hey, this is all intellectual. I'm not intellectual. Be inclusive. Just hear what it's about. And in the end, that will work out.
Let's say you have a young graduate from Stanford School to provide the design education. What do you teach this person, assuming that you cannot do it all?
Well, this goes back to a provocative statement I'll throw out there that many, but not all, but many designers across all of our different fields, they subscribe to one design religion, and they're largely unaware, the majority. They're not aware of other ways of doing design because they've really just done design from their field and they've done it for that application. And the other thing that's really interesting is that quite often the latest generation of designers are largely unaware of the history and the interwoven paths of these different design disciplines, particularly before they were formalized. And for most design applications, it was in the 1980s during a variety of different school endeavors, and then in the 1970s and 60s for other applications. And that goes into a whole, really long, discussion. But point is, sometimes when you talk to a person who's very eager and ready to do design with you, and you ask them about other types of design, it goes back into the one true religion discussion of, well, no, you don't need to do that. You just need to do it my way. Well, where did your way come from? Well, I'm not really sure, but it doesn't matter. My way is the way to do it. And so I find sometimes the design discussions default into planning discussions. And so that's where provocatively I would say, if you do design or if you do planning, if you are open-minded and you are a reflective practitioner, you should always be curious as to what else? What else? What else is there? And perpetually critically thinking about why and how you do what you do. And is there another way? Is there a new way? Is there a different way? Is there a hybrid where human-centered design with agile, with army design methodology maybe, or Israeli systemic operational design, or some other strange combination where you get these practitioners together and then, boom, there's something new and it's exciting. But it's really hard to get that conversation going because most people come into the room, not all, but most. It's almost like having people trapped in an elevator that are fans of different football teams. They're going to beat each other up, but they're never going to say that they love football.
This is really interesting because it's actually fundamental to how we teach is that there's all of these different paradigms for design. And truly, if you want to be a design thinking designer, you need to be able to mix and match and adapt and refine and be reflective through these combinations that you question and come to new ways of working. Design is a very broad term and it's really used for two fundamentally different things. We talk about design as delivery of something where more or less we know what it is. But we also use it to talk about this much more open-ended kind of thing where we don't really know what's coming out at the end. And these are really different things. If you know what the outcome roughly is going to be and you need to get there, then suddenly there are this methodology, it's well understood, your organization already embodies it. It's about delivery and efficiency, and that makes sense. If it's about there's an unknown out there that we want to kind of explore towards, of course you can't use a delivery approach.
The tension between a solution mindset and a learning mindset. And I think there's a distinction there. And a true design practitioner has to figure eight loop between both of those effectively. You can't do just one, but you can't do the other only as well.
You have to question the problem.
Yeah.
Just to see what the group thinks about this, as you described, our client is a cup company. They want a better cup or another cup or a different cup. A cup, right? We know cupness is going to come at the end of this thing, right? Versus this more open-ended, hey, what might be all the ways in which people might stay hydrated, right? Pushing the future out, thinking about the more abstract, higher level considerations of hydration and human requirements. I think there's a third way of thinking about design, and Ben and Jeff and Philippe would be following the dialogue and the literature. Those are two very valuable ways of doing design, and probably the most prolific around the world if you're to just take a snapshot of everyone who's doing design. That's how they're doing it. militaries, I think, at least in the form that I see it being practiced in the circles that we work in, is equally interested, if not more so, in not how to make a better cup or not how to help people stay hydrated, but how might we put a mirror up against ourselves as an organization and think about how we might need to evolve and think differently about human hydration. So the design itself is of the self. You're designing or reimagining your own relationship to cupness or hydration. And I think that's a fascinating twist on the design discussion, and that almost everybody wants to affect the world through new products and new services and new conceptualizations of experiences, et cetera. And oftentimes with a commercial or a profit motive behind them. And it's even better if we can align it with sustainability goals and increasing net joy and reducing net suffering in the world. I believe in all of this. At the same time, I am fascinated by the idea of applying design to the self at the individual, team, and organizational levels. And I'd be curious to hear what
it is. Yeah, I think that makes it interesting. Like, they have this whole design your life course, what it's done for, what is doing this. I've seen it working very well for individuals, but when you look at more organizations, like, how do you get them ever into such a mode? So I think that makes it very interesting. It's like, okay, can you really use it as like some self-improvement? Because that's a bit what it comes down to in the end. We have a lot of self-improvement techniques that are more based on quick fixes, and then design should bring in something more substantial, something more reflective. But it's, again, it becomes very strategic. If already like the great leaders don't want to accept that we're bringing in design to deliver a product, how do we ever convince them that we can bring in design to reflect upon themselves? I think that's what makes it interesting. Like the more away you get from the product approach of design, the more of the challenge you get.
Yeah, from products to people.
Exactly, yes, yeah. And I think products, like most of the leaders, are kind of fine with. And then the more you get to, okay, the processes, okay, the process that also going to include me, because I'm normally designing the process now, and now the designer is going to design the process. And as soon as it comes about people, it's like, okay, but then it's really about my position. It's like higher up in the hierarchy, and I'm going to deal with that. And I feel sometimes that design doesn't really have practical solutions for that. Like in theory, that works very well. Like, okay, we can design everything, like also processes and mindsets. But how do you implement that in different contexts? I'm not really sure if like the design as a field has an answer to that. Maybe it's more, maybe it's another perspective that actually knows how to work with this political and hierarchy challenge.
Yeah, actually, so I wanted to respond to that. How do we all think, at least when I'm teaching design thinking and design, it's very much doing design, operational job done. But like, most of our engagement with organizations, when we're teaching them design thinking, like, they're competent. They know how to operationally do something. We're almost exclusively talking with them about design thinking as a strategic tool, as a management level tool, where it's very much about understanding the organization and getting an organization to accept flexibility in this operational level. So it becomes almost like you're never going to do design at operational level if you cannot get a strategic vision that gives space for uncertainty.
Well, you won't have the in-house capability. You'll have to continually outsource it, right? Like, you'll have to hire design firms to do it for you.
And if you set a problem to them that's super specific, you're never going to give space to re-question the problem. And it's interesting because there's almost the primary thing that we deal with when we're dealing with organizations is getting leaders in, getting the senior management in.
Yeah, of course, this is the idea of we want to reach in education. It's like, okay, we can change organizations, but I think we see so often they don't. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And is it because of the design element itself that it worked? Or what is that play there? So that's what I mean.
There's a tension between conservation, and this goes into what is a senior leader? What do all senior leaders generally have in common? And a senior leader is generally elected or put at the top of their organization for a variety of reasons. In some societies, it's because of birthright, although that's largely been phased out. And in most, it's some sort of merit-based combined with experience, wisdom, hierarchy, influence, power, money, one of these combinations. Either way, these people are in charge. And the first thing that there's a lot of force for them to do, social forces, is to conserve. Because probably what got them to the top is the type of structure or system that they are going to try to attempt to preserve that, because that's what got them there. The opposite side of that tension is going to be this disruption of introducing change. And when you look at CEOs or military visionaries who left-turned their organization at a radical time. Apple is a great example that's thrown out there. Billy Mitchell in the interwar period for what became the U.S. Air Force is another example. There's lots and lots of them, right? And when you look at all of these, right before the innovation started paying off was when the vocal critics were their loudest, and that person or that leader might have actually failed or been removed. And that's fascinating to me. because the tension here becomes the act of creation is actually second. The first act, which we don't want to talk about much, is the act of destruction, because an idea or a thing or a process or a structure that is currently there needs to be destroyed, even conceptually, because in a human-centered design application, when you're prototyping because you're destroying the existing artifacts because they're insufficient and you want to replace it with a new one.
Does that imply that subversion actually precedes destruction? Because you have to conceptualize of your destruction. So it's this subversive behavior.
Yes,
right?
I think you're absolutely right. And this really gets into the social construction of reality and how design plays these really fascinating roles within our organizations, in that if you are a leader or if you have that type of influence where you can influence a leader and you're doing design, the first act that you have to persuade using narratives and metaphors and innovation is we need to destroy this thing, this idea, this whatever. And the second part, if the person is willing to go along with you and the organization is like, okay, is, and here's what we proposed we replace it with, which is better. But now the paradox becomes, if you propose to destroy something that is sacred to that institution, the more sacred that thing is, the more that the castle wall would be filled with archers getting ready to pull their bow. Not this. And then they fling their arrows. That is the struggle. And so what are you willing to destroy as a designer? And how effective can you persuade your organization to do it in order to bring about that innovation?
In my research around the world, I see a trend in military design that if you look at the doctrine and all that, it's always that attempt to change an environment to make it better from a single perspective. And the more I did interviews, and if you look at what Dr. Ofra Grasher from Israel is doing, or what Ben and Nathan or others at Canadian Forces College, there's a higher number of people who are telling me that in the end, when we start the design inquiry, when we end it in the military, we ended with a design concept aimed at changing ourselves, because we discovered that we were, or something in us was, the main or first problem we needed to solve. And it leads to organizational design, basically. Is it a trend or a tendency that you see in engineering or architecture?
Very much. Like, large engineering organizations tend to frame problems that they understand and think, if we keep doing, maybe we do better, we can get to these radical goals. And in reality, something significant needs to change. A lot of organizations are sort of making statements like, right, this date, we're going to be 100% carbon neutral or 100% sustainable, whilst basically doing something that is never going to achieve their end, manufacturing trucks or making cement or things that are fundamentally not sustainable are produced by that organization, and no amount of finesse is going to achieve like 100% sustainability.
The fur coat industry is going to be 100% non-animal.
They at least envision and intend a good direction, but within the context of their system, it's impossible to really conceive how that's going to happen.
What is lab grown for?
It's a different industry then.
Yeah. Totally concur. From a military perspective, I saw it in Afghanistan as well. We were fighting in our province with the Taliban because it was the enemy. They need to be defeated. So every troops in combat was successful. However, our troops got more and more and more in contact. So the approach was more of the same. Bring in more troops, engage the enemy in a more aggressive way, bring in heavier weapons, and well, it didn't help. So people were like, we need to do more planning. We need to do more of the same, so-called Red Queen effect. Eventually, then the commanders saw as well, I'm losing. We're going wrong here. And then eventually, you get a designer's approach, co-creation, own dialogue, looking at your epistemology, ontology, how am I thinking, how am I looking at the environment? Is this what we want the situation to be like? Or do the experts see things differently from a different perspective, bringing in multiple people? Were the first steps into design actually led by failure because they saw it's going the wrong way? And then you see people step aside from the Holy Grail, which is the planning process, because they see it's not working. What do we need to do? And the first step was actually not necessarily throw out the planning process. However, first reflect on yourself and take it from there.
Everybody wants to change but nobody wants to change themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Change is horrible.
Sure.
Yeah. Like breaking down your mental model of how the world works and then throwing that up in the air.
I saw a good one I liked the other day. This guy making a point. He said, it's not that people are necessarily afraid of the new thing, but they're terrified of letting their old thing go. We've got a letting go problem, not a newness problem, but we've got a letting go problem. I thought that was an interesting twist on it that speaks to our, well, what I think is the larger topic issue that we're getting at is one of identity. And, you know, I know there's a couple of postmodernists in the room. I'm curious if anyone wanted to weigh in on the role of identity in
This will be for another
podcast. It will be a second episode.
We just got to the meat.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about identity, but I think it is worth mentioning that modern cognitive theory would say that the vast majority of our cognition is not conscious, is system one. And that's built on, you know, rapid fire processing that requires mental models to be in place. It's a sort of machine learning kind of metaphor. If you're sort of destroying those mental models, that makes it very effort intensive and very scary, and you can't rely on your gut instinct anymore. And that makes sense then that people don't want to change. All of their gut instinct is trained in one way. If you suddenly say, hey, it's not like that anymore.
Which brings us back to exactly where we started, which was around the role of tolerance of ambiguity and embracing uncertainty as being a differentiating quality between people who thrive in design environments versus people who don't.
Yeah, we actually do this in some of our education with military audiences. We just did it yesterday with the Danes. There's this great TV show called Brain Games, and I watched it once with my kids. And there's this great optical illusions they do where you're looking at a clamshell, and then there's another one where there's two rectangles. And your brain actually interprets this real information from reality. And as it's processing it and assembling it for your consciousness, sometimes your brain will distort reality to make it make more sense based upon the evolution or our biological backgrounds. But it rarely happens. But when it does, our brains are comprehending a distortion of reality that we don't even realize. And so we illustrate this with the students. We even tell them, take a look at these two rectangles, and we're about to superimpose behind it the railroad tracks going off in the distance. And you are going to feel that top rectangle getting bigger. It's because it's this biological overriding instinct of the brain that very quickly process information for survival, which has aided us for tens of thousands of years. But right now, at where human beings have been able, because we're clever enough, or maybe too clever, we've created all this technology and all this amazing stuff, but we're able to now manipulate reality in ways that our brains are actually hardwired to go against. And so now the challenge becomes, can we at least become aware of that type one thinking? Because people just go right into this automatic process of thinking all the time, whether they're consuming goods, producing goods, or in war, doing rapid decisions in order to try to achieve some sort of a security objective. Breaking out of that is hard. Exactly what Phil said. It's so hard to do because it's so much easier to default back to that type one. It's so much easier to believe what your brain is telling you versus what your eyes are actually seeing.
So just last topic for the last 5 minutes, we announced in the beginning, how do you see design practice changing with the development of technologies like AI and big data? So there's a big buzz around it. So
you want to do that in 5 minutes?
Well, easy.
let's just give it a try and see how it goes. And if you guys are really motivated, we can do another one on this later.
I could wrap that up in 30 seconds. Artificial intelligence for design will eliminate all doctrine and planning above the tactical level. What are your questions? I know. I'm sorry, I'm being provocative, but I do think that long term, all of the bureaucratic processes that you currently see being done by human beings right now, a lot of that stuff in security environments are going to be just regulated down to artificial intelligence and automation, because we don't need to do this. We don't need to worry about munitions, fueling. All of these things are currently done by human beings actively, but a lot of that can be regulated into type one behaviors that can be automated, which then leads to the question of, okay, well then what does it leave humans to do? Well, can they continue to be the decision makers in combat? I would argue that in the long term, no. Because things will be able to occur far faster than the human decision cycle. We are biologically limited. And once it exceeds that ability, human beings unfortunately just won't be able to, because things will be happening so fast in a security environment, particularly against a technologically equivalent or superior force, that we can't make the decision. So then you say, okay, perhaps I'll entertain that, and hopefully Skynet doesn't happen. But then what do humans do in combat? What do humans do in security? And I think the only area that still remains would be creative thought, innovation, these types of things. But even there, will artificial intelligence be more creative?
All right.
This is like a long way
off. I can't help. So every time Skynet comes up, whether we're working with a military audience or sort of a hybrid, people chuckle. But I always wonder if it's a nervous laughter. You realize that it's not a movie anymore. Right, like we are already using artificial intelligence and robots to do work that's really close to killing, if not at the edge of it. Right, like there was a hostage situation. I think it was in Texas a year and
ago. Parking garage.
In a parking garage, instead of exposing SWAT team members, I believe, to an armed gunman, they rolled a little robotic tank in there with an explosive device, and they took the guy out. Right, so we're right on the cusp of this conversation. Not that I look forward to my AI overlord, but I can't wait to create a new seat at the design table I'm really looking forward to co-designing or co-creating with my AI partner. I think that there's a wide range of tasks that AI can already do better than humans, and I can't wait to tap into that competency or capability to help me design better.
I would also add that the irony of the universe is winking at all of us is because literally right outside of this building on the fence on the other side are huge advertisements for the next Terminator movie. Yeah. I just have to throw that out there.
But it's interesting you mentioned AI as a collaborator. I think this is also where the at least community that I'm involved with also see maybe the nearer term future will be smart machine actors doing design that you're collaborating with because they have better information search and synthesis. Longer term, it's going to be really interesting because how many jobs really cannot be automated when you think 50 or 100 years away? Not much is left.
They even have abstract paintings now that are
done. I think pretty much artificial intelligence is already at the table, but nobody's yet seeing it. It's not in our brain being depicted over there. From an interesting movement I saw back in the Netherlands is procurement of, for instance, submarines or the F-35. The Navy says, we need new submarines to the industry, and the industry wants to start designing. And it said, all right, what do you want? 4 successors, medium, nuclear, do you need missiles? Or do you want to have roboted vehicles? Do you want to have them AI? What do you want capabilities? And that really stresses out the Navy, because the Navy just wanted to have 4 new submarines in their traditional education and all the logistics and everything. And they said, but we have to change everything. And we have to rethink about all maritime warfare, the whole before buying these things. So you see, all right, what is the role of artificial intelligence now and in the future? And you see they started to bring in design from a military perspective interwoven with the industry because they want to have some capability on the water, but it's not yet determined what it looks like.
I can't help but chuckle at that great NASA story about, you know, we spent $20 million to manufacture this pen that could write upside down in space, whatever. And then they chuckle and say, well, the Russians used a pencil. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll spend all this money, develop this great autonomous submarines with great capabilities. And the Russians strapped a super GoPro on a beluga whale, right? So we kind of have to check ourselves sometimes with this conversation. But, you know, in general, I'm long on AI.
We'll find it very interesting to see. Like, if you believe that design thinking is this cognitive process, this cognitive activity that we do, then we are kind of the limit where what AI can still take over. Because maybe that also makes us a bit more to understand, like maybe not everything of this design thinking is cognitive. Because if there's some limit of what AI can take over or not, like maybe there's other things that it cannot take over. That explains a little bit better what design thinking exactly is then. So, and maybe that's 5 years down the line, maybe that's 100 years down the line. So interesting to see that.
Another aspect that we are already noticing is that with AI beating Go, the Chinese game, or getting so good at the game like StarCraft, AI is showing us different ways to play the game that we would never imagine. So if one of the deliverable or the early grail of design that sponsors are looking for are game-changing approaches, well, AI may cover some of our blind spots that we would never imagine otherwise. And this is coming. I think the fear again is the lack of reflexivity. If we just let AI design for itself and we just don't think about the unintended consequences and all that, but it's probably inevitable that it's going to be our design partner in the future.
But there's something about that, especially in these games, it's already taking up some kind of reflective role, right? Like it's still very limited reflective. Like they are already really thinking about, if I play Go or chess or whatever it's doing, it's like, what does this mean for not only for this game, but for the bigger context in which I'm playing these games, which is, of course, only a very small part of being reflective, but it can do that already now in that context better than we can. So,
when artificial intelligence is truly at a far higher level, I would bring into question, I think almost everything goes back on the table to include the nature of war. Because everything up until now has been written and crafted and created within a human being context. Biological, time, geospatial, everything. You know, even
cyber notwithstanding.
Cyber notwithstanding, right. And cyber is the first part that is really disrupting all this. So if you look at the history of human societies and the application of violence through all of history, human beings have been the ones that have inflicted violence upon other human beings using increasingly sophisticated tools. Now, if you look in the past, just the past 100 years, or a little bit more than 100 years, human beings in the air have been able to inflict violence upon other human beings, either in the air or on the ground. However, the United States Air Force and other militaries that are able to afford drones and aviation that does not require pilots, they are coming up against a cultural norm that ties back into this human-centered tip of the spear, lethal decision maker, is that are we willing to exchange where the human makes a decision with the artificial intelligence? And it's not just a technological edge. There's cultural and historical and sociological elements here. So the United States Air Force, for example, the ace, the fighter ace, is a very important status, and they're rare, and they're becoming increasingly rare because very, very few enemies, the Taliban don't have an Air Force, right?
Yet.
But when you run in, I remember running in during the Iraqi invasion, my brigade commander met the Air Force counterpart, and as they were shaking hands and joking around, or someone introduced him and said, oh, by the way, he's one of the few aces that are still, you know, in service or whatnot. And what was fascinating was that, like, there was a ripple of laughter, and then there was a little bit of sword fighting, if you will, between the infantry brigade commander and his combat jumps versus the Air Force guy, his ace shootdowns. The advent of systems thinking in our recent military decision-making, which only really came in the 1980s and 90s, effects-based operations being one of those applications, right? And yes, there were some issues, but what it first was attention against this ace, is that in order for you to have more aces in an Air Force, you have to have enemy pilots that are willing to fly against you so that you can shoot them down. Text-based operations and systems thinking, an application of systems thinking, would say, you know, you need to blow up the barracks that the pilots are in before they even get to their planes. And that's actually a better outcome. But the challenge there is, even though it's more efficient, you now lose the ability to generate aces within your organization.
Jeff, I'm pretty sure Ben just suggested that the barracks were the center of gravity for those the enemy Air Force.
We're going to
quote him on recognizing the cog.
I mean, we're all talking about the people we work with and the organizations we work with need to question the systems in which they work. And I think AI is an interesting one for researchers as well, because all of our models of design are developed from a human-centric context. All of our models are either grounded in cognition or other conceptualizations of how people think and work with design. And it'll be really interesting to see whether any of those sort of theoretical models of design really hold up in an AI era where it can potentially perform in ways that really not anticipated, perhaps.
For this reason, I'm fascinated by, there's an open source conversation happening around Neuralink. And what does this computer-mediated design process, what might it look like when wonderful conversation between Elon Musk and Jack Ma, the CEO of Alibaba, that happened a couple of weeks ago, up on YouTube. And Elon is talking about the role or the importance of that interface, because now in trying to communicate with AI, and it's funny, he describes what he thinks it might sound like to an AI when we try to communicate with it via speech. It's like its processing speed is so much faster than ours that our speech probably sounds like some nasally whining, like slow whale cry. Like it has to tolerate us typing with our thumbs to slowly input single characters at one time, right? Think about how painful, to apply a human metaphor to the AI experience, would be. We said we have to find a way to accelerate the conversation between people and the machine. And so Neuralink is the mechanism to which we might be able to do that. Then the second thing that I really like from that talk, and what I would suggest listeners check out, is he describes AI as a series of degrees of freedom puzzles. So it first beat us at checkers because the rules and the set of moves or potential options are so limited. But then it beat us at chess. And then, to fill up your point, it beat us at Go. And now it's beating 99.8% of all StarCraft players with a fantastically complex set of moves. Every one of these has an increasing range of degrees of freedom, and it's not slowing down. So anyone who's arguing that, you know, this AI is bullshit or machine learning is all smoke and mirrors, I would argue that it just, you haven't felt it yet. And I'd lean on that great observation that the future's here already. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
I think it's the perfect way to close this podcast. Thanks so much to the participants who really contributed to a very rich conversation. Ben, Phil, Jeffrey, Nathan, and Robin. Just to wrap this up, we started talking about if there are any differences between design principles across professions. Basically, the conclusion is that no, the principles remain almost the same. It's just that the humans and the organizations are different. So we need to find a way to better adapt our design practice across these professions. The ethical aspects are also different. especially if you compare, for instance, practicing design in a military context in comparison to an engineering context. I remember our first conversation, Phil, when you said that the ethical concerns of designing a spoon is totally different from the ethical concerns of designing military operations. And also that there are nonetheless byproducts from practicing design, from what we observe, hence reflexivity, and also what we see as the turn towards the self and the organization instead of trying to change the environment around us as the main output. Then we closed with AI, how this might change design practice in our respective professions. I think it's a primer for a much longer debate, but most of you concur that this is likely a game changer for design practice.
For the record, I welcome our machine overlords.
And thank you. San Dimas High School football rules.
So thank you so much for listening.